We're looking at the last of some facts that are very good for us in terms of making the case for the resurrection of Jesus. The five things that we've been looking at are things that even skeptics will generally admit. Now, when we appeal to these things, we're not appealing to them on the basis of what most people believe in. I want to make sure that that's clear. None of us should base our beliefs or convictions on the number of people that buy into a certain thing or will admit a certain thing. What we're looking at are five things for which the evidence is so good that even people that don't believe in Jesus as the Son of God, they have to admit. We've talked about three previously. What was the first one that we talked about? Jesus died by crucifixion. The second one was what? The disciples believed they saw him risen from the dead. And the third one?
Paul's conversion.
He was a man committed to Judaism far beyond anyone else in his day, and then he became committed to Christianity. It seems far beyond anyone else in his day. So today we look at the last two of the five. The first one being the conversion of James. Let's go to Matthew 13. I have never paid James much thought. And I guess probably that's true of most of us, apart from the book that he wrote in our New Testament. A key phrase in there, of course, that was drilled into me from an early age, faith without works is dead. A very good phrase to be familiar with, good verse to know, because of the religious confusion that we are surrounded with today. But in our study this morning, what we're going to look at is not what faith should produce. That's what James argued, it ought to produce works. But we want to know what first produced faith in James. If you look in Matthew chapter 13 and in verse 55, Matthew is recording some of the parables of Jesus. In fact, Matthew 13 is often called the section on the kingdom parables. You find several of them grouped within this one chapter. In verse 53, when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed from there. He came to his hometown and began teaching them in the synagogue, so that they were astonished and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brothers, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And his sisters, are they not all with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" Where is this guy from? Thought we knew this guy. Thought we knew his background. Of course, that's the central question about Jesus throughout the Gospels. In the midst of the list of his family members, we have one name in particular in verse 55, James. Of course, these two verses alone are interesting. A lot of people would think that Mary spent her entire life as a virgin, but that's obviously not true. And Jesus had an extensive family. At least four brothers and sisters, which a full number of is never given to us at any point in the Gospels. In Mark chapter 6, you find a list of his brothers again, and the name James is found among them once more. We want to skip that one and go to John chapter 7. John chapter 7 and verse 3. Actually, let's start in verse 1, John 7 and verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the feast of the Jews, the feast of booths, was near. Therefore his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples also may see your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Notice what they say in verse 4. If you do these things. An expression of doubt. That's evident from what John says in verse 5. For not even his brothers were believing in him. Now for the moment, as we go through the Gospels, as we've said before, we're not assuming that they are inspired at this point. And we're not arguing that they're inspired at this point. Right now we just want people to examine them as historical documents. When we talked about the kernel of the gospel, the four key facts as they are presented to us in the four books and in Acts and 1 Corinthians, that Jesus died, he was buried, he arose, and he appeared. We talked about some things that historians look for to determine whether or not a text is trustworthy. And one of the things that we talked about was the principle of embarrassment. Now, what is that? One of the things that people say about the gospel writers, John included among them, of course, is that they made all this up. Now, if they made it up, though, John 7 in verse 5, this is a real problem. People generally don't make something up that's going to possibly damage their credibility or ruin the case that they're making. Look over in John 20. So let's just test this book by the principles of historiography. What would people look for if they were studying this just as a historical document to see whether or not it's trustworthy? Well, John tells his audience in John 20, verses 30 and 31, why he's writing this book. And this follows after the exchange between Jesus and Thomas. You may remember in verse 29, Jesus says, Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. In verse 31, John says, these signs have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. The you there in verse 31 is who Jesus spoke of back in verse 29, those that did not see. Who does that include? Us. That's right. So here I am, I'm reading John's book, and John says, I'm writing this so that you'll believe in Jesus. By the way, none of his brothers believed in him. What? I haven't seen Jesus. I could not pick him out of a police lineup. But these men could. They grew up with him. They played with him. You know, if you wanted to know something about John Whitehead, you could talk to Elvira, you could talk to his kids, you could talk to his sons-in-law, but there's somebody else in here you could talk to. Who's that?
Ronnie.
Yeah. If I want to know something about Jesus, whether or not he's a good man, he's credible, I could go to his brothers. He's got quite a few to pick from. And then John says they didn't believe in him. What that tells you is that when you get to John 7 and you read about the unbelief within his own brothers, that's more than likely 100% true. I know everybody in here would already take it to be true anyway. But just arguing from a historian's perspective, it's got to be true. Nobody's going to make that up when it is potentially embarrassing for the case that John makes. So we have the brother of Jesus. He's a skeptic. Now look in Galatians 1. Galatians chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. Paul is recounting his experiences after his conversion. Of course, he becomes a Christian in the city of Damascus, and then sometime after that he goes up to Jerusalem. He says in verse 18, 3 years later I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas, which is Peter, and stayed with him 15 days. But I did not see any other of the apostles except James, the Lord's brother. In Galatians chapter 2, he mentions in verse 9 a James, Cephas, and John. And this is in reference to a debate that is held in the church of Jerusalem in Acts 15. And the James there is also the Lord's brother. We'll talk more about that here in a moment. But what you have here in Galatians 1 and in Galatians 2 is a reference to a man who is active in the Jerusalem church. He's now a believer. So we have confirmed skepticism. And then at some point in his life, he goes from a skeptic to a believer. And not just any old believer, he's a prominent leader in the early church. He is well known among the church in Jerusalem, and evidently even the churches in Galatia, comprised of both Jews and Gentiles, they know something about him as well by reputation. You can infer that just from Paul's own references to him. And the same thing could be said of his reference to James in his letter to the Corinthians as well. So he's a man of prominence in the early church. He's not a closet believer. like Joseph of Arimathea. Nothing like that. Look at number 4 on page 39. When you go over to the book of James, a book that is attributed to this same James, the Lord's brother, he writes to a group of suffering people. And they're not suffering simply because there's a famine that's hit the land. It's pretty clear, as you see also in books like 1 Peter, these people are suffering because of their faith in Jesus Christ. And we've already talked at length about why that was. You have a man like Paul before his conversion who's whipping up persecution against these people. You look in James chapter 1 and verse 2, for example. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Say, what? That's not the way people naturally think, but that's one of the paradoxes of the gospel over and over. It often calls upon us to do things that don't come to us naturally. Not that he's saying to be happy when you suffer, but be content when you face trials. Verse 3, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. This is a man that says every trial that you face, you try to milk the benefit from it. This can make you into a better person. This can make you into a better disciple. This is the man that said, Jesus, if you really believe all this stuff, don't do it secretly. Go out in public. Go ahead and challenge your enemies, because I really don't believe in you. Now he's saying we should be content when we suffer. Down in chapter 2 and verse 1, my brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. Obviously, he shares that faith in the glorious Lord Jesus Christ at this point. Here's a man who writes for people to steadfastly endure suffering for Christ's sake with joy, and he himself practiced the same. Josephus, first century Jewish historian, born around 30 AD, dies about sometime after 100 AD. He is a primary source for many events in the first century, including the downfall of Jerusalem and the sacking of the city by the Romans. And this paragraph that we have on number 4, he mentions James and his death. The younger Ananias, who, as we said, received the high priesthood, was of a bold disposition and exceptionally daring. He followed the party of the Sadducees, who are severe in judgment above all the Jews, as we've already shown. As therefore Ananias was of such a disposition, he thought he had now a good opportunity, as Festus was now dead, and Albinus was still on the road. So he assembled a council of judges and brought before it the brother of Jesus. And you'll notice the next thing he says, the so-called Christ. Why does Josephus say the so-called Christ? He's not a believer. But he does admit that Jesus lived, and that he had a brother whose name was James. Together with some others, and having accused them as lawbreakers, he delivered them over to be stoned. Here's a man that practices the very thing that he wrote in James 2 up to the point of death. So we have a profound change in a man that arguably would have known Jesus better than anyone else. And it raises a natural question on number 5. Why the change? Look over in 1 Corinthians 15. First Corinthians 15 verses 3 through 8, you have the kernel of the gospel. Jesus died, he was buried, he arose, and he appeared. And then beginning in verse 5 down to verse 8, Paul gives a catalog of appearances. In verse 7, he says he appeared to James. Some of the early Christian writings indicate that this is James, the brother of the Lord. And if you read commentaries, or if you read some of these early Christian writings, they will often refer to James the Just. He is not called that in the New Testament, to my knowledge, but when they use that terminology, that's who they are referring to, James, the brother of Jesus. Now, just because they say that that's James doesn't necessarily mean that it's so. But there's some pretty good indicators that the James that is mentioned here is indeed the Lord's brother. First of all, if you look at the other appearances that Paul lists here, beginning in verse 5, he appears to Cephas, that's Peter, and then to the 12, obviously the apostles. In verse 7, at the end of the verse, he mentions all the apostles. And in verse 8, last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. Every one of these appearances that is mentioned in verses 5 through 8, with one exception, and we'll talk about that in a second, is an appearance to somebody that was obviously already known to these brethren. Someone in a position of influence and prominence in the early church. The only break in that pattern is verse 6, where the emphasis does not seem to be necessarily who he appeared to, but how many. He appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now. So you have people of prominence. Now, when you get to verse 7 then, this James, you might think, well, we've got a few important guys named James. We have two apostles named James. We have James, the son of Zebedee. Who's he related to?
John.
John's brother. And then we have James, the son of Alphaeus. We know next to nothing about James, the son of Alphaeus. We know a little bit more about James, the brother of John. But the interesting thing about those two men, every time they are mentioned in the Gospels or in Acts, they are, as far as I can tell, always identified by either being the son of Alphaeus or the son of Zebedee, or in the son of Zebedee's case, he is often identified as the brother of John. You do not find that kind of identifier mentioned in verse 7. And when you read about the brothers of Jesus, you don't find any special identifiers attached to their names either. And as I said a moment ago, we know that James, the brother of the Lord, was a man of prominence. That's clear from his role in the Jerusalem church. Paul references it in Galatians, and Luke mentions it as well in Acts 15. So there is good reason to think that the James that is mentioned here in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 7 is the brother of the Lord. So, again, why the change? What better explanation is there than this one? At the very least, and this is what I say at the bottom of the page, at the very least, you would have to concede that James believed that he saw his brother raised from the dead. At the very least, you would have to admit that. All right, any questions about James before we move on to the empty tomb? Keith.
It's more of a question than a comment, but having siblings and most people doing here, you would think that he would have struggled for the longest time with the duality of Jesus, the fact that he is my physical brother, but on the other hand, he claims to be the Messiah. It'd be like knowing the Pope before he became the Pope, or the President before he became the President. You know them growing up, you see them as your brother, and then this guy's claiming that, hey, he's the one who's coming to save us all. I mean, he came from the same mom I did. I've grown up with him. He didn't take a bath two times a week. And all the small stuff. The fact that you have that sibling bond, to understand that he's, to take it for what he's saying he is, take what he's saying at face value, that he really is the Messiah. And he's just my brother. He may have all these other people fooled, but then he's come full circle. To me, he would be the ultimate test, because he is the one who saw Jesus on a daily basis. He had that close personal relationship with him. And if he can be swayed, if he can be converted, you would think that other people would too, because he had that from the very beginning, that personal relationship with him. He would be the one who would expose anything if he was a fraud. So, a.k.a. maybe like Joseph Smith or some other people who claim to be prophets.
Right. The reason for their unbelief is never explicitly given in the Gospels, but Keith makes a good point. It's not unreasonable to speculate some probable causes as to why they might not have accepted readily the notion that their brother, the son of Mary, was also the Son of God. And, of course, we have to admit, we're speculating at the end of the day, but It's not impossible to wrap your mind around why that could have been. And for us, it's a good thing to know that people so close to Jesus were skeptical, as Keith pointed out, and then eventually got on board. That speaks once again to the power of the evidence that is presented to us. All right, page 40. Yes.
When you talk about it took them so long to get on board, I look at his mother. These are her children. She was there at the wedding when he turned the water into wine. She was there at his conception, at his birth. She knew there was something special about this kid, this man. Did she not talk to the other kids, the other children that she had, his brothers, and tell them all of this? And I struggle that they don't believe her.
Yeah, I do too, and I don't have answers for all of that. I would go back to what I said earlier about the principle of embarrassment. I can at least feel confident knowing that it's true that they did not believe. As to why they didn't, I don't have an answer to that. I don't know. But for us, we would think the virgin birth alone is enough to bring somebody to faith, or turning the water to wine, or walking on water, or bringing Lazarus from the dead. We would think that. But the fact that wasn't enough, evidently, but then the resurrection was, that speaks to the power of the resurrection and should give us some confidence in knowing that we're not on the wrong track in making the case from the resurrection for who Jesus is. And I contend again and again, it is the single best piece of evidence to use that he is the Son of God. All right, let's talk about the empty tomb. This is the fifth and final of these facts, that the tomb was found empty. At Acts chapter 2, when the first gospel sermon is preached, what city are they in when the sermon is being preached?
Jerusalem.
Now that's interesting, because this is about 50 days after the crucifixion of Jesus. And what city was he crucified in? I'm seeing a pattern here. What city was he buried in? Jerusalem. So you mean to tell me that if, for example, in Acts 2, I was in that audience and I heard Peter get up and make some interesting statements, like he says in Acts chapter 2 and verse 32, "This Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses." Where is it at? He quotes from the Old Testament in verse 31 and makes application to Jesus. He speaks of the resurrection of the Christ. He was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. What if I didn't believe him? Could I test him? It's a short walk from Pentecost feast to the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. I could go over there and I could find out for myself whether or not the tomb was empty. And the fact that he's proclaiming this in the very city where Jesus was both slain and buried, knowing that it's not hard for people to test whether or not he's telling the truth, it all means that he has to be at least telling the truth about the empty tomb. It is empty. If it wasn't empty, would any of us be here on a Sunday morning right now? That would have killed Christianity, just as surely as they killed Jesus on the cross. Now, there's a couple of objections, or one objection that's raised to this. If you look at the top of page 40, letter A, beneath number 1. If Jesus had not... Let me start that over. If his body had still been in the ground, and then 50 days later, you have these men saying that Jesus is risen from the dead, the very thing that the Pharisees wanted to stop from happening. What do they have to do to make sure that they nip this in the bud? All they have to do is roll the stone away, drag the body out, and put it on display. Now, somebody might say, well, they couldn't do that, because after 50 days, that body is looking pretty gross. And nobody would be able to recognize it. Couple of problems with that. First of all, if you look on letter B, the climate in Jerusalem is very dry. It's not like the Gulf Coast. And in that kind of a dry climate, after 50 days, you could still see a corpse's hair, stature, and distinctive wounds. You could have identified all that. You can still do all that after 50 days in Virginia, where it's a little bit more wet than it is in Jerusalem. And in fact, this refutation comes from the coroner's office in one of the cities in Virginia. So if it's possible, even after 50 days in a wet climate, how much more so in a dry climate? Now look at this, for example. You can still identify their hair, their stature, their distinctive wounds. If all that's true, that explains why they didn't, first of all, drag just any old body out and say that that was Jesus. There were at least two other men that were crucified the same day he was. So maybe we don't have his body, but you know what? We've got to stop this. So let's dig somebody's body out, and we'll throw it out. There's a problem there. Those men had their legs broken. John says explicitly in John 19, Jesus' legs were not broken. So there's some peculiar wounds on those bodies that would not be on his. There's also a wound on his body that's probably not on theirs. Yeah, the spear in his side. Not only that, but they say you could still identify their features, their hair. People would have known after 50 days even whether or not this was Jesus. And then, of course, regardless of the condition of the body, his enemies would still have thought it good to produce the corpse, even if it was barely recognizable. Even if they at least could have said, let me put my hand where they thrust the spear into his side. That would have killed the whole thing right there. Ennis? Could have been, and that's a fair point to make. Yeah, there very well may have been people that did go back to the burial site and decided to test Peter's words, and that's a good point. And if people did, we know 3,000 converted on Pentecost. Of course, the total number of people there far exceeds that on the feast day. And let's say it was people among those that didn't convert. They decided, I'm going to go test this for myself. Who knows how many of them did, if they wanted to. And yet, the movement goes and goes and goes, spreads and spreads and spreads. Look at Matthew 28. Anytime that a skeptic or an unbeliever wants to make the case for the resurrection, I am happy to let them do it. It makes my job a whole lot easier. And that's exactly what we have here in Matthew 28. It's interesting that some of the... Well, I guess the very first consideration of an alternative theory for the resurrection, it's recorded and it's contemplated by a Christian. Matthew is the first one to detail other ways of getting around the fact that Jesus was raised by the power of God. And in a few weeks, hopefully, we want to look at some more explanations that people suggest. My point in mentioning that is this. It's good to know these. And it's not wrong for, yes, even a believer, not that I'm saying this is what Matthew did, but it's not wrong even for a believer to wonder, well, is there another way to explain it? Should I test my own faith? See how well it holds up under scrutiny? Is there any weight at all to other methods of explanation? There's nothing wrong with considering those. And in fact, I would argue it's going to strengthen your faith to test those theories. One of the things that strengthened my faith the most in the Genesis account of creation was not necessarily looking at all the evidence for creation, but seeing just how badly the theory of evolution did when stacked up against scientific data. That was an eye-opener for me and a real boon to my faith. And I think the same thing is true when you study the resurrection as well. So in Matthew 28, in verse 11, the women have just left the risen Jesus, and they're on their way to the male disciples. And we are told that some of the guard came into the city while they were on their way and reported to the chief priest all that had happened. All that had happened is recorded for us back up in verse 2. The severe earthquake that occurred an angel descending from heaven, rolling away the stone, his appearance like lightning. Verse 4, the guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. So now they're on their way to report to the priest what happened. And in verse 12, when they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers. They say money talks, and sometimes money can make people not talk. Verse 13, you are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble. And they took the money and did as they had been instructed. And this story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. Now, if they say in verse 13, his disciples came by night and stole him away, what have they just admitted? It's empty. There is no body. When people today say they hallucinated when they saw the risen Jesus, what have they just admitted? They saw something. When they say that he didn't die on the cross, but he passed out and then he got out of the tomb and he appeared to them later, what have they just admitted? They saw something. Okay? So, listen to what people say and think about the implications of the statements they make. If the body's stolen, that means it's not there. Now, Matthew says in verse 15, the story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. When he says to this day, he does not mean 2017. He meant the day in which he wrote the letter, right? We don't know when this was written. Maybe as early as 40 AD. We know no later than 70 AD or just before that. Maybe fairly early within Christianity. And I say that because it's obvious that this is written to Jews. And there was a clear need to try to win Jews over. That was the initial focus of the apostles, to take the gospel to the Jewish people. And it may have been as late as 10 years after Pentecost, before you read of the conversion of Cornelius, when the focus shifts to Gentiles. So fairly early on, but still, if it is that early, it's still maybe 10 years later. So for 10 years, they've been telling people far and wide, he said it was widely spread, that the disciples stole the body. So for a very long time, even people who have not yet obeyed the gospel, they at least know that tomb was found empty. And the fact that there is no surviving record from the first century that challenges what Matthew just said about the story that the Jews were telling is interesting, because if he had been making that up, if he had been lying, you know somebody would have challenged him, and you know that record would have been preserved until today. Another thing about this, I believe it was Justin Martyr writing in the second century. He said, even that far past the crucifixion, that the Jews were still telling people the disciples stole the body. So they're still admitting, even if they don't mean to, that the tomb was found empty. Yes, sir?
So people would rather believe a lie than the truth?
Imagine that. Imagine that. Yeah. So we have here two key reasons already to believe that the tomb was found empty. One, Peter says that in the very city in which the tomb was located, and people could have easily fact-checked him, and if he was lying, that would have ruined him right there. And secondly, even the enemies of Jesus admitted that it was found empty. Now the third one, at the bottom of page 40. Finally, there's the testimony of the women. In all four Gospels, who are the first people to show up and find the tomb empty and then go and tell everybody else? Women. In every single one of them. And this is striking because of the low regard Jews and pagans had for women. So, the first quote that we have here from the Talmud. The Talmud was a Jewish commentary on the law. It recorded some historical facts about the Jewish nation as well that are not found within the Bible, and it was considered of value to those people as a means of interpretation. This is their own words coming to us from their own books. Sooner let the words of the law be burnt than delivered to women. People talk today sometimes about the male privilege and how women are mistreated today. Even if that's true, we've come so far from the first century and the way that Jews and pagans regarded women. The second one, The world cannot exist without males and without females. Happy is he whose children are males, and woe to him whose children are females. Make you feel good, doesn't it, ladies? And then we have Josephus. Now, this is good for us because he's writing in the first century after these events took place, after the four Gospels were written. Let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex, nor let servants be admitted to give testimony on account of the ignobility of their soul, since it is probable that they may not speak truth, either out of hope of gain or fear of punishment. In other words, don't trust a woman, because more than likely, she's not telling you the truth. She either hopes to get something out of what she's saying, or she's just afraid that you're going to hurt her if she doesn't tell you what you want to hear. On the next page, another quote from the Talmud. This one having to do with the submission and evaluation of evidence. Any evidence which a woman gives is not valid to offer. This is the thinking of people in the first century. It's still a world dominated by men and their role in society. And this is the world in which Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John sat down and put pen to paper. And I want to tell you about who found the empty tomb, and I want to document the historicity of the empty tomb. And I know, by the way, that you don't care what a woman says or thinks, but guess what? That's what I'm going to tell you about. Why does a man do that when he knows that his audience is already prejudiced against a woman's testimony? Does he do it because he's making it up? Or does he do it because he's just trying to tell the truth? Does he do it because the tomb was found empty and the facts are women are the ones that found it that way? I mentioned in Luke 24 and verse 11 that it may well be that this played some role in why the disciples reacted the way they did. You don't need this explanation for this to make sense. Obviously, those men thought that they understood what was going to happen with Jesus and what the messianic kingdom would be like better than what they actually did. And when they hear from the women that the tomb is empty, Luke records that their words appear to them as nonsense and they would not believe them. And maybe it is because of societal prejudice. Maybe they did wrestle with some of that. I don't think it's unfair for us to say that all of us at some point struggle to escape prejudices that we may not even be fully aware of and how they impact us at times. That could well be it. But you don't need that in order for this account to make any sense. If you look on letter F, we have another quotation from Suetonius. He was writing about the time of Caesar Augustus and the low regard that he had for women as well. And we'll skip that one for length of time. All right, so we have three reasons to believe that the tomb was found empty. The first one being the Jerusalem factor. Here's everybody in the city in which all these events took place. They can easily decide whether or not for themselves Peter is telling the truth about it being empty. The fact that the enemies of Jesus admitted that it was found empty, and the fact that the earliest testimony that we get for it being found empty is from women. And in the first century, if you were making this all up and trying to win people over as a con artist, you just would not start out that way. You would know your audience better, and you would not make women so prominent in the gospel story. So let's talk about the final takeaway then. Five stubborn facts. The first one, Jesus, what? He died by crucifixion. Of that, there can be absolutely no doubt. And yet after that, the disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus. And then this man who was not part of the inner circle of the original disciples, a man who was wholly devoted to Judaism, he becomes a Christian, says, I saw the risen Jesus. James, skeptic, goes to servant, says he saw the risen Jesus, and then the tomb is found empty. Put those five things together, harmonize them, and draw an inference. What is the most logical way, even if it is the most improbable way, resurrections are not a dime a dozen, what is the most logical way to explain and account for all five? I would argue that these facts, none of them in and of themselves being supernatural, they point to the greatest supernatural event in the history of the world. Jesus did return from the dead. I have a quote from Sherlock Holmes. Yes, I know he's fictional, but I love him anyway. And I love the expression that we have here. And I'm going to apply it in our next series in the course as we move on to consider the alternative explanations. Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. The resurrection is highly improbable. That does not make it impossible. However, there are many alternative explanations that are offered from a naturalistic perspective that assume at the outset that there is no such thing as a miracle, or that any of this stuff as recorded in the Gospels cannot be true, that even by their own evaluation, and even if you just stick to the natural details of the case, they have to be impossible. They will not work. They will not adequately explain all five of the facts that we just finished talking about. So Lord willing, on Wednesday night, we will move on to that next section as we begin to eliminate the impossible. Thank you. About the enemies of the tomb?
Yes. What they did not do on the day of Pentecost is further evidence that there was no body.
Right. Arrest the apostles.
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they would have been totally embarrassed because they couldn't present the Bible.
Right.
And so all that would have done is fuel the story.
Yeah.
So they were between a rock and a hard place. They couldn't arrest them.
Right.
They had no evidence to substantiate the arrest.
If the enemies had genuinely thought that the disciples stole the body, did they have any means at their disposal of getting the truth out of them? Yeah. Yeah, we talked about it at length already in the case of Paul and Peter and others. So surely, if there had been any lick of truth to that at all, they would have taken steps to make sure they got the truth out of them. Good point. All right, thank you for your time and attention.